I'm Nancy Mendoza. I'm reporting for Micropod from the Society for Applied Microbiology's winter meeting. I'm at the Royal Society in London today, hearing scientists talk about water safety.
This was a man in Florida that thought he'd been bitten possibly by a spider. This was taken by his wife. He died, I think it was about 16, 18 hours later.
I'm here with Professor James Oliver from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Professor Oliver has given the Denver Russell Memorial Lecture today on a bacteria called Vibrio vulnificus. I've also got Professor Oliver's colleague, Dr. Craig Baker-Austin from CFAS in the UK, one of the UK experts on Vibrio vulnificus. Can I start by asking, what is Vibrio vulnificus? I hadn't heard of this organism before today. Why is it important?
Well, it's a bacterium. It's a salt-requiring bacterium that occurs naturally in coastal areas, beach areas, not in the open ocean, but in estuary environments. It's normal flora. It belongs there. It's not pollution-related. But it's able to cause human disease by two different routes of infection. People who eat raw seafood, especially oysters. Its occurrence is at very high level in oysters. And if you eat raw oysters, you have a chance of coming down with the infection that it causes. That infection is called primary septicemia. It gets into the blood, and it carries about a 50% fatality rate. So it's the most fatal foodborne disease in the world. It's also able to cause wound infections. These are infections that occur typically in, again, beach environments, maybe when somebody is fishing, angling, just recreational activities, gets a little cut, doesn't take very much, an ant bite is sufficient. The bacterium can enter into that bite and cause a wound infection. Those often require amputation and are about 20% fatal. It's very important for the most part that the people who come down with these infections have some underlying disease, primarily liver diseases like cirrhosis or hepatitis, that tends to predispose them to infection.
That sounds pretty scary, but how common is it?
Well, the bacterium occurs worldwide. It's at highest levels, highest detectable levels in warmer environments. Gulf of Mexico in Florida area in the United States is the highest incidence, but it does occur worldwide. Numbers are not especially high, but in filtering shellfish like mussels and clams, they get their food by filtering seawater and concentrating this bacterium. So the numbers in an oyster, for example, can be very high. Again, although it may be only tens or maybe hundreds in seawater, that's sufficient to be able to initiate a wound infection. One of our big concerns is that while it does occur worldwide, it definitely prefers warmer waters. You don't find it at less than about 13 or 15 degrees Celsius. So our concern is with the global climate change and increasing seawater temperatures, which is happening globally, its incidence of that bacterium and other ones is increasing, and we're seeing cases where we did not used to see them before.
When the bacteria that doesn't really like to grow under 13 or 15 degrees, Dr. Baker-Austin, does that mean that we're safe in the UK from this? Our seas are quite cold?
Overall, we don't find this bacterium very often around the coastlines of the UK. Like you say, it grows in warm, low salinity water. One of the few places we do see cases now is in the Baltic Sea and in the transitional waters between the Baltic and the North Sea, so sort of Denmark, southern Sweden. The water temperatures there are normally cold most of the year, but they get significant heat waves. It's been several heat waves now over the last 20 years. There's a big one in 1994, another big one in 1997, 2003, 2006, 2010, and also last year in 2014, and we had these big heat wave events. Of course, these bacteria like to grow in warm water, so you get two things going on there at once. You get the right conditions. These are low salinity environments, so they're perfect for Vibrios. The water temperature increases, so these bacteria proliferate in the water column. And also, at the same time, there's a behavioural, there's a human factor there. People don't want to go swimming in the sea when it's cold. When it's warm, people go, that's great, let's go swimming. And so you have these several different things going on at once, and that's why James just mentioned there about climate change. One of the aspects of climate change, heat waves, I think, is likely to increase risk in the future.
Something that Craig said there, I would emphasise it, this bacterium, while it requires salt, like seawater, it doesn't like open ocean levels of seawater, so you don't find it in the Mediterranean, for example, because the salt level is too high. But in intermediate areas, about half-strength seawater, like the Baltic, like the Black Sea, and numerous other estuarine areas, that's when you get the combination of warmer temperature and lowering salt levels, that's the real danger area.
This sounds like a bit of a Goldilocks bacteria. It likes the kind of perfect level of salt, the perfect temperature. But that's occurring, you know, in more parts of the world.
I mean, one of the places that we do a lot of work and we're very interested in, like I said before, is the Baltic Sea. Parts of the Baltic Sea, parts of the White Sea, which is the sea between Russia and Finland, are warming at incredible rates of change. So some of those environments are warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius per decade. So within a few decades, we're likely to see far more of these environments opened up to pathogens like Vibrio vulnificus that can cause these serious infections.
We know that Vibrio vulnificus is quite a nasty infection. It's got a very high mortality rate. And it sounds like, you know, what you really don't want to do is eat raw oysters from these areas where the salt and the temperature are exactly right. But are there other risk factors that make it more likely for you to end up with an infection?
The main risk group are males. About 85% of the cases of ingestion are in males, and especially in males over the age of 40, something like 95% are over the age of 40. We think this has to do with the level of cirrhosis that is predominant in males over females and which increases with age. Cirrhosis of the liver, whether it's caused by alcohol abuse or hepatitis, damages the liver, releases iron from the liver into the blood, and that's something that these bacteria have to have. So being male over the age of 40 and having a risk factor which decreases your immunocompetence or has an elevated level of iron in your blood because of liver cirrhosis, those are the main things that put these people at risk.
This infection is more common in men, but is there any reason why women don't get the infection with Vibrio vulnificus?
Well, it appears that the toxin that the bacteria makes when it's in you, that women with their levels of estrogen, their natural levels of estrogen, actually helps protect against that toxin. And, of course, that level of that estrogen is very low in men, is probably not a factor. So I think among the various aspects, estrogen does have a protective effect for women.
Wow, so we've got here a very interesting bacteria, one that, you know, perhaps in northern and western Europe we're not so familiar with, but I think we should be looking out for that as we see the sea warm up a little bit. Thank you very much for your time, Professor Oliver and Dr. Baker Austin. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
So agriculture, back to the farming. Cryptosporidiosis is one of the chief causes of diarrhea in neonatal...
I'm sat now with Dr. Frances Lucy from the Institute of Technology in Sligo. Dr. Lucy's just given a talk at the meeting about the risk of infection from recreational water. And one of the things that she's doing is using some organisms that live in those waters to assess how dangerous it might be to go swimming or do other water sports. Can you tell us a bit more about what you're looking for and how you're using these organisms?
It's a very good idea to use the natural small invertebrates that live in the bottom of lakes and rivers to actually give us an indication of whether these waters are contaminated with nasty disease organisms such as Cryptosporidium and Giardia. And we can actually take samples of these. Some of them are actually invasive species, like the zebra mussel, which occurs in very high numbers in these waters. And we can actually easily remove samples from the water and take them back to the lab and analyze them to see whether or not there's a risk there for people who want to use the water for swimming or boating or fishing. And similarly, we can also, at the seaside, take samples of our natural native marine mussels and do the same thing, and it gives us a good indication of safety.
It's almost like these mussels are safety taste testing the water for us. Where would we see zebra mussels? How are they different from the ones that, you know, we're more familiar with?
Well, zebra mussels are an invasive species. They've been in Britain actually since the 1800s, but recently their numbers have increased. They're present in many lakes and reservoirs, and they're in very high numbers. So they're about the size of your fingernails. They are striped, and that's why they're called zebra mussels. And they live between 2 to 3 years, so that gives a long time for them to actually filter out any of these pathogens and allows us to remove them and to analyse them.
What are the sorts of risks that occur in those waters?
I actually became infected myself following sampling in a small Irish lake, became quite ill with gastroenteritis, and the analysing the shellfish will detect a number of organisms that can cause gastric illness in humans and also in animals as well. And the zebra mussels can filter about 1 litre each per day, which is quite a lot given the fact that they're very small, and so they're very effective monitors.
So they're filtering the water, and then any bacteria or viruses that are in that water are getting sort of stuck in their gut, is that right?
That's right, and of course the converse and probably more dangerous side of that is that this also happens with mussels and oysters that are being used for human consumption. So viruses and bacteria and other pathogens can actually be present in shellfish. So people who are gathering shellfish just as a recreational activity need to be aware of that, and they should always cook their mussels and oysters before they consume them, because the pathogens are usually killed, and most, possibly not all, toxins would be denatured. I wouldn't recommend that anybody would consume raw shellfish unless they buy them from a very reputable source.
It's not just mussels that you're working on. You're working on another little organism that lives on the beds of lakes in Ireland. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, the water hoglouse is a cousin of the normal woodlouse that we commonly find under stones and in damp places on land. And the water hoglouse is an indicator of organic pollution. And it's actually known that the juvenile stages prefer to consume fecal matter as a food source, so that they're naturally decomposers and consuming. They're crawling around on the substrate where the organic matter is present. So they're actually very important and useful ways of biomonitoring rivers and lakes for Cryptosporidium and Giardia.
You're actually finding these hoglouse larvae around in a stretch of water, you can be pretty sure that you've got some raw sewage in there or some runoff from agriculture. So you said the hoglouse is related to the woodlouse, which is something that I'm sure we're all familiar with, but it actually lives under the water. What does it look like?
It looks exactly like a woodlouse. In fact, if you pulled one out, you would think that it was a woodlouse. They are very common in water samples, but when you get large quantities of them, as I said, they do indicate some type of pollution from organic matter.
And you're doing the same sort of thing with the hoglouse as the mussel. Are you looking at what's inside them?
Exactly, yes. So we take the mussels or the hoglouse and we process those, and then we put them through a biomolecular process in the lab that will give us an estimation of the presence and the prevalence of these organisms in that particular water.
What does that involve? Are you sort of grinding them up and then putting them in test tubes? What does that look like when you're processing them?
We use an industrial blender to blend the mussel and the hoglouse samples. The mussels, obviously, they're in shells, so there's quite a lot of grinding up to be done. And then basically it involves a sort of a settlement and then removing the supernatant, the surface on the top of the settlement cone. And then we use a fluorescent method of actually detecting the organisms. So when you use a special type of microscope, a fluorescent microscope, you can actually see these glowing in the sample. You can count them.
I was thinking that, you know, what you'd see would be sort of petri dishes with colonies growing on them, but what you're actually doing is looking with a microscope at individual bacteria, so you can pick up, I guess, quite small numbers. What sort of numbers are we talking about?
Typically, you know, you could get anything from maybe 1 to 20 per sample, or, you know, probably a sample of about 150 grams. When people think about microbiology, they think a lot about culturing and increasing the numbers in order to be able to identify them properly. That's not what we do. No, it's a different type of methodology where we're just counting the existing cysts or oocysts that are present in the sample.
This sounds like a fascinating area to work in, and one where you get to sort of go out and about and get down and sample some of these beautiful lakes in County Sligo. What attracted you to doing research in this area?
Well, in truth, I'm not a microbiologist. I'm a freshwater ecologist who works mainly on invasive species like the zebra mussel. And I became involved because during a long-term project, I was approached by some American colleagues to ask, would I be interested in sampling mussels from different areas of different types of environmental pressure and providing those samples for analysis to see whether they were contaminated with pathogens. So it is just sort of a byproduct of effective networking with good colleagues and friends that sort of resulted in my expansion into this area. But it really is a good fit with what I do, because it's all got to do with improving and monitoring and managing water quality in Irish River Basin districts.
Thank you ever so much for your time. You know, next time I'm out boating on the lake, I'll think of the zebra mussels and the hog louse doing their bit to keep us safe.
Thanks very much, Nancy.
Thank you, Dr. Lucy, very much.